The job of the blender is to combine these elements in such a way as to produce an overall flavour.
A wider repertoire of different beverages than ever before.
I think one of the most interesting breweries, and certainly one of the most interesting origin stories for a brewery in Australia.
Single malts, blends, grain whiskies, bourbons and more.
If you want mezcal to be sold around the world, then unfortunately you're going to have to make a compromise.
This is the Drinks Adventures podcast. I'm James Atkinson. And this is the show where I speak to some of the world's most exciting producers of beer, wine and spirits and uncover trends and issues in the drinks industry today.
We've certainly got our backs against the wall. I don't have any major funder supporting us. So, to be honest, it's a day-by-day hustle at this point.
Andrew Fitzgerald of the Melbourne rye whiskey distillery The Gospel speaking there. As the pandemic took hold back in April 2020. He's back with us for this opening episode of Season 13 of the Drinks Adventures podcast. So you're going to find out what's been happening at The Gospel since then. And we'll be talking purely about rye whiskey rather than hand sanitizer. And more specifically, The Gospel's recent entry into the US market. It seems a bold move, taking Australian rye over to the home of rye whiskey. So I asked Andrew first up, how he and business partner Ben Bowles came to this decision.
The US was always part of our strategy, even when we developed the brand. You can sort of, you know, certain things that went into the style of the brand, whether it be the name, the type of whiskey which we make, you know, fitting within the category of straight and straight rye whiskey. Those things were all sort of had the US market in the back of our mind. However, we're going into the US now with a very different playbook to what we were initially planning.
How so?
Well, look, in March 2020, I was booked on a plane to go to the US. So I was looking at schools for my children. I was going to migrate over there and manage a launch into the US proper, with a full sort of bricks and mortar rollout. Obviously, the pandemic really put the brakes on that, but for a lot of ways, it was for the better. It enabled us to sort of focus more on the Australian market, which we're going to continue to do. And with the US now, instead of going all guns a blazing from the get-go, way we're entering it now is first e-com. So we're going sort of a DTC e-com strategy. We can
direct to consumer, we should say, for the consumers at home who aren't familiar with that kind of industry lingo.
Exactly. So we're basically setting up an online store that deals with the US, and that enables us to ship to about 40 different states, and then we can market into those states, work out what comms are working, work out what states we're getting traction from, and really inform our later rollout, which will probably happen towards middle of 23 for proper bricks and mortar distribution. But until then, it's very low key, just looking at this e-com offering.
Bricks and mortar sort of meaning, you know, getting a distributor and dealing with that difficult three-tier system that they have over there and getting your product out into bricks and mortar stores and bars, I assume, as well.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, at the moment we have a distributor in California which enables this e-com rollout.
So you have to have a distributor to do what you're doing.
However, it's part of that three-tiered system, as you mentioned. But the US is essentially, 52 different countries. So if you want to roll out to multiple markets, you need basically either one of the large distributors who are across multiple markets, or you pick up a bunch of smaller distributors per market. And I think that's all that takes a lot of energy, a lot of cash. People think, you go into a market, the booze sells itself. That is definitely not the case. So we're very cautious to do that any time before we're 100% confident.
And with the conversations that you've had with people over in the US and you tell them, we're an Australian distillery and we're looking at bringing our rye whiskey to the US, how do you convince people that there's a place in the US, the home of rye whiskey, for The Gospel?
Well, you know, actually, it's often met with enthusiasm. I think what people, you know, some people see it as us selling ice to the Eskimos, but really what we're doing is we're selling them a product that they're familiar with. If I was to go to a US consumer and say, hey, I've got an Australian whiskey, the question is, what is that? You know, what is an Australian whiskey? Is it like an Irish whiskey? Is it a single malt? You know, what is it? Whereas if I say, hey, I've got a straight rye whiskey made in Australia, it's a different conversation. It's one, it's a product that they're familiar with, and then two, it's a location in which they're excited about. You know, there's often a positive response to being an Australian product, which is good.
And what do you kind of talk them through in terms of, you know, what makes the Gospel Rye different to the ryes that they might be already accustomed to?
Yeah, I kind of feel as though there's two camps within the rye whiskey category. One is the ryes that drink a lot like a bourbon, which are probably the most prominent ryes which we find on the market. And then there's
sort of more the traditional Kentucky style rye.
Exactly. Yeah. High corn content, a lot sweeter, you know, sort of finish to them. And then there's the more ryes that drink like ryes, the ones that are often over 60% rye. My first introduction is to say, look, we're definitely a rye, leaning towards that sort of drier, spicier feel of a rye. One of the things that's different about us is obviously we reflect the climate and where we come from. First of all, the grain is grown in a very dry, arid area. I guess a key differentiator for us in that market is we talk about that climate and the impact on it. And then we mature in New American Oaks in the Australian climate. And we've done a lot of research, including Ian, who works for us as our master distiller. He wrote his thesis in regards to maturation and looked at the different climates in Australia. And it's really quite interesting, even compared to Kentucky, the fluctuation in temperature in Melbourne is much more extreme. So these are the talking points that we use. You know, the climate and its impact on the grain, climate and its impact on the final sort of maturation.
And it's 100% rye as well, which even yes. Within that kind of category of ryes that are quite, you know, more yeah. Sort of robustly rye flavoured, that's probably still pretty unique over there, I'd imagine.
Yeah, I mean, there's a few of the more craft, you know, when we talk about craft, it's interesting. Craft in Australia and craft in the US is definitely a different end of the spectrum, but there's certainly some more craft distillers in the US which are doing 100% rye, but the majority do use some form of either the ryes are sort of got some form of corn in there, or they might have some barley in there or something like that.
What about the specific flavour profile of the rye that you guys are making with that unique rye grain that you're sourcing from the Murray Mallee? How does that kind of, in the glass, with all the tasting that, you know, that you would have done of US ryes versus your rye, is there a distinctiveness that particular grain variety has due to the variety, obviously, and where it's grown?
100%. I think the production of whiskey, it's a recipe that can't be replicated whether you use the same ingredients, right? But what we tend to, you know, produce both for our distillation process and the grain that we use is an overtly grain-forward whiskey. You know, you can almost taste the cereal bread. You can certainly taste the, you know, that dark rye bread flavour. And I think that's something that carries across quite different compared to, you know, American-style ryes. And, you know, I likened it to sort of almost tasting the dustiness of Australia in the glass, but balanced out quite heavily with the type of oak that we used.
There seems to be quite a lot of debate and discussion and around, you know, how much impact variety and terroir does have on the finished whiskey. And I think I sent you through actually a recent study that I read on that topic. You guys obviously firmly in the camp that stuff is still really important to how the finished product ends up tasting even after it's spent, you know, a few years in American oak.
Yeah, first of all, I think the biggest impact comes from the variety, without a doubt. I think the variety of grain, not necessarily species of grain, but say if you have a certain strain of rye versus another strain of rye, we certainly see the biggest impact happening there. But terroir is, people can argue it and debate it and, all that they like. All as I can say is our own experience. And I wasn't a believer in terroir before trying it, but I can tell you I can have the same variety of rye from two different locations and taste the difference in the new make spirit. We've done it recently with, our standard rye, which we get out of the Murray Mallee, and a rye which we've sourced down in Gippsland. And it's, in the white spirit, it's significantly different. So we're yet to see those come through to a full 3-year product, but certainly in the new make, we can taste it.
One thing I notice when I'm over in the States is how sort of competitively priced their spirits are over there. You can get a really good bottle of rye whiskey that pretty cheaply.
Yes.
Are there challenges for you guys in kind of getting your product onto the market at a competitive price over there?
I mean, the exchange rate is certainly helping us a little bit there. But
I haven't actually noticed where it's at the moment.
I think it's sitting around 72 or something like that. So the exchange rate does help us a little bit. But, yeah, all through the value chain or all through the supply chain of alcohol products, the person that's making the least is often the producer. that's just the way it is. The US is a challenge for us to be competitive with the $20 bottle pours, and you're right. I mean, you can get some delicious rye whiskey for sort of $30 a bottle over there. As an avid consumer of rye, I quite enjoy my US travels. However, the growth in the categories which are seeing the most growth are those super premium categories. And it's because people are not necessarily looking for something that's been mass produced, but they're looking for something that's unique. Has a sense of place when they're drinking it. So, and that's where we're sitting. So, bottom line is we can't compete with the cheapest. We're placing ourselves in that super premium category and happy to compete with some of the guys around that space.
And how much does that mean that your straight rye whiskey will sell for over there?
Look, between $45 and $50 recommended retail price in the US.
Yeah, that's pretty good. I might buy some bottles and bring them back when I'm over there.
Well, you do the exchange rate. It's about what we are here. So, yeah, feel is free. I encourage you to buy it wherever.
I thought it might have been slightly sharply priced. But
there's lots of people between us and the end consumer that ends up trying. As much as we're going direct to consumer in the US, there's a couple of aggregators that work between us and the actual end consumer.
Are there any particular rye whiskies over in the States that sort of inspired you and Ben that are amongst your favourites?
One whiskey that really stands out to us in a distillery that we visited in our 2016 reconnaissance trip when we were sort of developing our rye theories was a distillery just outside of Seattle called Woodinville. Does a bourbon and a rye. They actually do 100% rye. Percentage of their 100% rye is a malted rye, but the majority of it's unmalted. We'd just spent all of our time in Kentucky. We'd been to sort of Willett and several other sort of distilleries in Kentucky, and then we went through other parts of the South, through the Carolinas and the like, and visited multiple distilleries. But when we got up to Washington State, and tried this rye, just the quality of it stood out. They had control over where they were sourcing their oak from. They had, had a vision in regards to the rye which they were using, and all those things sort of fed into how we sort of wanted to operate when we started producing whiskey, both control over our barrels and using 100% rye.
What about in the Australian market? How has the brand been received over the past 2 years since we last spoke? Are you getting some good online traction with, you know, a lot of bars being closed around the place?
Yeah, well, in March 2020, you know, as we talked about, it's sort of panic stations because we weren't really in too many retailers. So our focus when launching at the end of 2019, which is when we launched, was to move into on-prem, move into bars and sort of focus on getting sort of, I guess, ambassadors through the bar network. That obviously wasn't going to help us, you know, once the pandemic came. So we had to work with our distributor. So we have a really great distributor here in Australia. We had to work with our distributor to move into off-prem retailers as quickly as possible and completely change our sort of online strategy, which resulted in the redevelopment of a website and lots of things like that. So how it's been received, I think it's been quite strong. I'm very happy with we hit our targets for 2021.
They would have obviously been, you know, revised targets based on the pandemic situation.
No.
We hit these are targets that you set pre-pandemic.
They are targets that we set in 2018 for year two.
Wow.
And we achieved them. So we didn't achieve them in the way I wanted to achieve them, but we achieved them. So, I'm very, you know, excited about this year. I'm hoping we get through this cloud of Omicron that we're dealing with at the moment, and we can finally get out the gate and really start pushing the brand and the products, as hard as we can.
Yeah, there must be a lot of upside for you if you can really open up the on-premise channel to support the direct-to-consumer and the off-prem stuff that you're doing.
Yeah, look, bars are very important, especially with a category like rye whiskey. So biggest markets in Australia is obviously bourbon and then single malt, and rye whiskey's sort of just a blip on the screen for a lot of people. So having bars being advocates for the category and introducing them to products such as ours or even other rye whiskies is hugely important for us. So when they open up, as much as they're open now, they're certainly struggling with resources and with the current crisis. But when that's clear, we're really hoping for some significant traction.
And you guys probably still enjoy, you know, a bit of a point of difference from most of the other Australian whiskey distilleries. There's, you know, there's probably only a handful of distilleries in Australia that are making rye versus single malt. So that must be good just to have that, you know, USP.
Yeah, I think what is kind of good about us is our brand has a singular focus at the moment. We're not trying to be everything to everybody, and that's a bit of a curse because, as I just mentioned, you know, the size of the market's not as big as, say, bourbon or single malt. So, you know, you're sort of fishing in a much smaller market. But what that enables us to be is a bit louder in that smaller market by having a singular focus. Rye is not just a side project for us. It's not just a, you know, we did it for fun type thing. It's a real focus. So, yeah, as I said, that allows us to be a lot louder in a much smaller market.
Tell me about some of the smaller batch releases that you've had. We've seen, you know, some single barrel releases. There's been some cask finished releases. Is that pipeline going to continue this year?
Yeah, I mean, we were 100%. We'll be releasing more projects this year, projects and hopefully a single cask. We're very much of the we intended on releasing another single cask the end of last year. And we just felt that the casks weren't ready, the ones that we really liked. So we just put them back in the rack and said, look, you know, we're best off not releasing the best of the best in a single cask because that is really an expression of unicorn casks as far as I'm concerned. When we release a single cask, is something that, you know, amongst the five of us in the distillery, we'll all look at each other and go, shit, that's delicious, you know, like, and that's what will hit as a single cask. In regards to projects, you know, this year we'll probably see our first larger alternate grain cask. So that means not all rye, sort of other grains in there, be released this year. We've got a couple of interesting cask finishes, and we've also got some products which have been fully matured in alternate barrels, which may come out this year as well. So there's a few in the pipeline, and what we're making now is gradually bigger and bigger project releases. You know, going from one cask to say two or three casks, and that sort of thing. So we will have a third SKU hitting the market the third or fourth quarter of this year.
As in addition to the core range?
The two core range, yes. It'll be somewhat limited in, say, in the sense of there won't be thousands and thousands of bottles, but it'll be enough to be able to get out and have it distributed through, independent retailers and things like that.
Whenever I've seen pictures of your barrel store, it looks like a really considerable size and a lot of whiskey you've got maturing there. Have you been expanding the amount of stock that you're putting down each year?
Yeah, so, I mean, we're currently operating at about 30% of our capacity.
Wow.
And that's all just due to cash flows. We're self-funded. Ben and I are just using our pockets, pocket money from years of working. So
you haven't had venture capitalists knocking on your door?
Feel free to send them my number, James.
Well, yeah, it's a double-edged sword, that stuff.
So. It is. It's a whole other debate as to raising cash, and look, we actually thought we'd need to raise cash last year, and there was a little bit of effort on our behalf to consider raising cash, but we've actually in such a wonderful space at the moment. We've got cash in the bank, we're growing a little bit, so we think that we can sort of continue alone for a little bit longer, if not forever, which is a good thing. Just in regards to whiskey stock, so we're operating about 30%, and we increase that year on year. Basically, with all whiskey, you think 3 years out, what are we likely to be selling? How many markets are we going to be in? What's our current velocity per distribution point? And, what's that likely to be? How are we going to increase that? And that's how we plan our whiskey production. We've got another bond store now and filling that up. So, it's certainly a plan to continue increasing our whiskey stocks.
From memory, your background, both yours and Ben's backgrounds, weren't in the liquor industry. How did you kind of skill yourself up in understanding the nature of distribution and logistics for a whiskey company?
Yeah, Ben and I both come from an engineering and project management background. Look, how we skilled ourselves up, I think, is making a lot of mistakes, I think, first and foremost, right? Burning a lot of unnecessary cash and just making a lot of stuff-ups. We launched, our first brand, Melbourne Moonshine, which I love dearly. The apple pie still is a reasonable performer for us. And I think through that, and the US trip in 2016, meeting with multiple distributors here in Australia, getting to know the bar industry here in Australia and understanding who's behind the bar, who's the tastemakers in this industry, all those things sort of took really from 2015 to, even up until this day, we're still learning, but that's what Melbourne Moonshine did for us. It was kind of a university of in the booze space.
And Melbourne Moonshine just kind of continues as sort of like a side label for you as
exactly.
Such.
Yeah. So one thing that we learned when you talk about, learning is one thing we learned is trying to talk to a consumer when you're trying to explain things to a consumer, and this is what sort of informed us about rye with the US is, if you have to explain to somebody what something is, it's just another hurdle to get them to consume it. If you need to convince them that it's okay to drink, it's another hurdle that you're facing. So that's why gin has done so well in Australia. You basically, people know what it is, know what to do with it. They drink it with tonic, right? Whereas moonshine, for instance, was, this is moonshine, this is what you can do with it, what is moonshine, explain that. So now the only product that we that survives through Melbourne Moonshine is we have the Apple Pie Moonshine, which we do sell quite a bit of because it's such an approachable drink.
And then you've got the dispensary, which is a gospel sort of, you can correct me if I'm wrong, but sort of like a sub-label that comes underneath the gospel for sort of some, you know, experimental collaborations and the like. Tell me about some of the projects that you've got happening there.
Yeah, so, you know, if you don't make things interesting in the distillery, it becomes a factory job, right? So the dispensary is a little bit of a way of us keeping things interesting and being able to collaborate without using whiskey as you know, our core range is the only collaboration tool. So with the dispensary, we've done a coffee liqueur using a whiskey backbone to the coffee liqueur. And then and we did that with Code Black Coffee, who are another Brunswick producer. We've done a limoncello with a lemonade producer out of the Yarra Valley, Yumbo. So that's all those things have sort of been kind of fun collabs, which, you know, you couldn't really do those with the gospel proper. And so this year we'll be doing a lot more of those things. We'll working on a little vermouth that we're going to release through that. Where, you know, we've got some other liqueurs. Obviously, Amaro's out already. So just it's really just a way for us to mess around, have some fun. The remit for it is it's either made from whiskey or it's going to complement whiskey or a cocktail of whiskey. So that's why we made our own bitters, traditional style bitters, so people can make an old fashioned. Using nothing but whiskey, essentially. So, yeah.
You'd be able to make a good Manhattan with the vermouth that you've got coming too.
That is the aim. So the it's been completely curated to make a perfect Manhattan.
Mate, thanks for joining me for a chat. I've wanted to get you back on ever since we sort of did that kind of weird weird conversation as lockdown kicked off. So yes. it's been fun just to talk whiskey.
Yeah, it is. And look, thanks for your support, James. And, you know, we're excited by a brand. And when we have conversations about it, it gets me reinvigorated about our company and our mission. So thanks for supporting us. And, you know, we'll speak again, I'm sure.
The Drinks Adventures podcast is produced by me, James Atkinson, with additional production and mixing by Dave Robertson. You can find complete transcripts, links, and other information on the show at drinksadventures.com.au. You can follow me on all social media platforms at by James Atkinson, like my Facebook page, James Atkinson Drinks Adventures, to be kept informed of podcast giveaways and other news about the show. The Drinks Adventures podcast needs your support as listeners. Please do us a favour and leave an honest review and rating for the podcast on iTunes or Stitcher. We love hearing your feedback, and it helps inform other people this is a show worth listening to. Or simply drop us a line at hello@drinksadventures.com.au.